And welcome back, everyone. We've got a great panel to kick off this segment. Joining Rick Rule are Doug Silver, Nick Michael, Louis-Pierre Gignac, and our topic is Understanding Development Finance, the Finance Stack in Mine Development. Welcome, guys. Rick, take it away.
This could, of course, this could cover the whole 8 hours. I'm delighted to have with me in terms of panel capital deployers, which is to say Doug and Nick, who deployed billions of dollars, literally billions of dollars, at Orion, and the representative of the Gignac family, who has consumed literally billions of dollars building mines around the world. So we sort of, I don't know where I fit really in that continuum.
But the equity piece.
Occasionally. So I guess what I want to discuss is the composition and adequacy of the capital stack. And I understand in the amount of time that we have available to us, we probably won't do justice to it. But what I want to ask people on both sides of the fence, which is capital providers and capital consumers, to talk about the different forms of capital available. As an example, senior project finance, overrun facilities, royalties, streams, equipment leasing. I don't know who feels like giving me a bit of an overview. I guess, Doug, given your own background in providing both royalty finance and streaming finance, you're the right one to start. Could you talk about how a retail investor might look at the capital stack and what red flags might cause them to kick the common equity consideration out of their portfolio, given the prior claims that other stakeholders have in the capital stack?
You know what I should do for you, Rick, is I have given a lecture at the Colorado School of Mines for the last 8 years on this. And it's six slides and it takes 3 hours to go through because there's just so much variety. And I tie how a project develops versus which types of financing you can use. I should see, I'm going to be doing it in February. I should see if I get him to film it and just send you the video and you'd have everything you want to know.
And we could perhaps add that as a free add-on to the people who've attended this.
Well, let's figure it out because I'll give it the presentation a dozen times.
Yep.
But listen, here's the answer, which is the earlier the project, the more it has to rely on equity and the less on debt. It's that simple. And if you throw in the royalty and streaming component, investors insist that royalty companies have revenues because they're, you know, a giant equity growth story. So you're not really going to see a lot of people. Cisco does it a little bit. Gold Royalties does it a little bit. But you're not going to see a lot of people creating royalties or streams at really early stage projects. That's the bottom line. When you get into the capital stack proper, say you've got one of these projects and it's ready to be constructed. Traditionally, we did 60% debt, 40% equity. Nowadays, because the debt market is so weird, there's so few debt players, what you're seeing is the royalty and streaming guys step in mostly on the debt side, but they'll take a little bit of the equity. So you're starting to see a split that's maybe 20 to 30% equity, 20 to 30% royalties, and the rest is debt. So the 40 to 60 debt, whatever the numbers are. That's how it stacks up. And it's totally tied to where the project, how much the project needs in the way of money, and how advanced it is to whether you can start properly leveraging it.
Should a retail investor consider royalties and streams as a different form of debt, perhaps subordinated debt? I mean, they do seem to come prior to the common shareholder in terms of claims on the asset, and they tend to have a disproportionate share of the revenue, at least after cost.
Only if you listen to McEwen. Royalties are not debt, and royalties are not equity. What royalties do that debt doesn't do is they are fully aligned with management and the project. So if the project fails, the royalty or streamers don't get anything. The debt guys still get their principal and interest, which makes it a more flexible product than debt proper. In terms of the returns, I think you might be mixing it up. The reason that the royalty companies are so valuable is because they're so scalable. Very, very few staff, very, very large revenues. no other company or industry in the world can offer that. So they're not really a debt. They get high returns because they get a high multiple on NAV. And as long as you got a, you know, 400 royalties or streams in the portfolio and they got new ones kicking in every year, it's a much more exciting story than just, you know, a one company with one mine.
LP, I'm going to go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, having gone through our project financing, obviously we relied on equity to get going. And when we did our real project financing, I mean, we went through the exercise of getting, you know, competitive proposals. And what came out really attractive for us was really having a stream because of the low cost of capital that was tied to it. And then really the competitive nature amongst the streaming providers these days. There's not that many projects out there where they can get meaningful streams, but you need a project that has a low operating cost, so you're not, you know, burdening your project that much. But yeah, for us, I mean, it was a really attractive means of financing our project. We were able to get essentially equity, debt, and stream from the streaming company, the royalty and streaming company. So for us, that was a very attractive means of minimizing shareholder dilution and in the end, you know, providing a better return on equity.
Let's go a little deeper into that. I'll quote first our mutual friend, Pierre Lassonde, who early on in my days with Sprott, when we were thinking about competing for a file, told me that his cost of capital based on NPV was sub-zero. And he asked me how I wanted to compete against sub-zero cost of capital. That did sort of tell me, well, first of all, it told me Pierre's a pretty good negotiator. But it also told me that in the right circumstances, quasi-equity contributed by royalty might generate a lower cost of capital for common shareholders than equity. And then there's that wonderful presentation that Silver Wheaton, that Wheaton Precious, Randy Smallwood does, which shows the revenue share consumed by a stream relative to the total amount of capital provided by the stream. Given that securities markets price EBIT at a royalty company, at a streaming company, at much higher rates than they do shares of operating mining companies. So perhaps you could talk a little bit more, LP, about how you saw your cost of capital affected, particularly by the stream, so that common shareholders can understand what they're getting in terms of leverage on common equity relative to what they give up by way, as an example, of the commodity upside in the stream or the after-cost nature of the revenue split with a royalty company.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at our mix, you know, we raised $481 million, of which $250 million was a stream. So that stream is going to be at 12.5% of revenue, you know, and they're paying 20% of spot on every ounce that's delivered. And there's a step down after that. But when you just look at the relative proportion of their funding, more, you know, close to half the cost of the project, and they're streaming, 12%, you know, call it net 10% once you put the 20% cash payment for the ounce. So for us, that was really a competitive financing package. And when we look at it based on, you know, consensus pricing, that was in the range of 5 to 6% cost of capital. If we were to have debt, that would obviously been in the range of 10 to 15% that we were discussing earlier. So for us, that was the best way and the most attractive way of financing.
One more for you, LP, before I go back and beat up Doug on the capital provider side. It's interesting, too, that you included Caterpillar in there in equipment finance. How, if you're at liberty to disclose it, what was your cost of capital with CAT? Was it built into the capital cost with regards to the equipment, or did it all come by way of juice on the loan?
Yeah, so, I mean, we have an owner mining approach to mining. So we buy the equipment and we operate it. So for us, it was all mostly Caterpillar equipment. So we're paying, call it a SOFR plus, back in, you know, when we financed the project, the SOFR rate was much lower. Obviously it's come up in the last, call it a couple of years now, but now we're just under 10% on equipment financing at the moment.
So Doug, let's go.
Would have been like 6-7%.
Yeah.
So Doug, let's go back to your Orion days and my Sprott days. Very often when either of us were providing senior secured project finance, we were providing it to companies that weren't investment grade credits, which means that they weren't borrowing money from either you or I at prime or frankly anything close to prime. I realize that both of us wrote term sheets that were 8% term sheets, 9% term sheets, or 10% term sheets. But then there were things like original issue discounts and other things. And my suspicion is that the total cost of capital for non-investment grade project finance from non-bank financials, like our own institutions, was closer to 15% money, all things included. Does that ring true for you?
Yeah, I think you're in the ballpark. You're probably within a percent or two, but in the case of Orion, you know, we also have a big metal trading desk.
Yep.
So by locking up the offtake, we could also get additional returns to us from trading the metal that the people borrowing the money from us would not receive. So. Yeah, it gave us higher returns than 15% for sure.
Did you see? Right. Did you see circumstances where people went with other capital providers and then sold offtake rights to the traffickers or something? In other words, what would you suggest that the total cost of capital in terms of the avoided, including the avoided offtake, was?
Or is that
proprietary?
Well, it's not so much proprietary as it's more complex than that. I'm not sure this is the right venue to get in the complexities. But, you know, what you do is you put together a finance package. And in the case of if you do debt equity in a stream or an offtake, you know, they're basically, you know, brothers. You're not going to exceed your fiduciary return on the debt. You might buy a point or two if you're lucky, but the real value is in the equity if it goes up and the stream or the royalty. That's where you're getting your returns. So, you know, one of the things we did is we would do a package, take care of them, cover all of their costs, and then we'd unload the loan as fast as we could because it was actually drawing our returns down. So it's kind of complicated, but, you know, if you use a number of 15 plus is what our returns are. Yeah, it's in the ballpark. But that's assuming the mine performs.
Of course. Every assumption that we make in investment assumes that, often erroneously. Many retail investors, I think probably encouraged by many investment banks, view the participation of sophisticated investors, be they senior mining companies, royalty companies, or streaming companies, presuming that they've done exhaustive due diligence, as some sort of imprimatur. It is often suggested by royalty and streaming companies that they provide technical and other advice to the operating companies. I'd like to hear both from Doug and LP whether investors should feel assured with regards to the participation of royalty and streaming companies in projects in terms of the due diligence and the operational support. Doug, you first.
Well, listen, I had Nick and his entire department. We did exhaustive research. And when it comes to helping them, it's because we're experts, as is the mining company. And if we see stuff that we think they could do better, we bring it up. And of course, if we have debt, you know, we control everything. So then we tell them what we want them to do. But in general, you're helping them because you're fully aligned. And if your expertise can say, hey, guys, have you ever considered doing this or doing that? Why wouldn't you share it? It's to everybody's benefit. So it's because we're aligned with the mining company that if they take our advice, it's on that basis. In the case of the big royalty boys, they also have a lot of excess of cash. So you're seeing them pump a lot of that into the community projects, which assists the mining company, because then they don't have to put that amount of money into the locals. But you get the same net effect, which is positive support for the community. Is that right?
All right. Sorry, I have to interrupt now, guys. We are out of time. Doug and Nick, I want to thank you for joining us for this boot camp and providing such great education for our attendees. We really appreciate it, and I hope to see you again soon. And you know, we'll be seeing you, Doug, at the July symposium. So thank you very much, and best wishes. Yeah, Louis Pierre, please stick around. Louis is going to be joining us later for another panel and also the one-on-one with Rick. So stick around for that.